now here's your host, Michael Corbett.
And good evening and welcome to this edition of the program tonight. We're going to explore the psychology of government secrecy. Is there an underlying motive behind the intense curtain of secrecy surrounding UFOs? And if so, what is it? Well, my guest tonight is going to discuss more specifically the psychology of dreamland, how secrecy is destroying public faith in government and science. Now, that's the title of a paper that he wrote and has published on the World Wide Web. Perhaps no location in the United States has generated more discussion than the super-secret test site known as Area 51, northwest of Nellis Air Force Base near Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, it's claimed by some that the government is conducting bizarre tests with out-of-this-world technology up there. We're going to explore these claims, and we're also going to be joined possibly, it's tentative, but we might be joined later in the hour by our resident in-house psychologist, Dr. Greg Wheeler, who's going to have some interesting perspectives as well to offer on this discussion. But before we go to that, I want to mention, has any one of you out there read Stan Friedman's latest book, Top Secret Magic? Well, if you haven't, it might be worth the trouble. This book, it centers on 10-year-plus controversy over the alleged documents called MJ-12 documents that were received in a very clandestine fashion by Hollywood producer Jamie Chandray and UFO researcher Bill Moore back in 1984. That this film was in a brown envelope that when they exposed it, it contained these documents that have been dubbed the MJ-12 papers. These documents claim that there was a group, a super secret group that was set up called Majestic 12 by the government in 1947 following the crash of the UFO, I believe it was at Roswell. What's really interesting about this book, though, is that Stan Friedman, as many of you know out there, Stan Friedman is an internationally known UFO lecturer who has, you know, been the big proponent of what he calls the Cosmic Watergate, the government's 49-year cover-up of real flying saucer mystery. But what's really interesting, and something we're going to talk about tonight in the program, concerns, you know, secrecy and the cover-up itself. There's a paragraph, actually a couple of paragraphs in the book that I found very interesting. And I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but it's an interesting thing to ponder. It makes you wonder just what the cover-up really is consisting of. For example, are we dealing with something that is a cover-up with the American people only, and maybe the scientific insiders have considerable knowledge about the science behind UFOs? This quote that I'm going to read you is on page 12 of the book. And keep in mind, this is Stan's beginning, kind of his beginning journey into the study of UFOs, and this goes back many years. But he was about to quit a job or lose a job due to government layoffs. He was a nuclear physicist, and he was working on some high-tech nuclear rocket motors and that type of thing. And he thought it was a great opportunity opened up for him when he went to work for McDonnell Douglas in Santa Monica, California, under Dr. Robert Wood, who was a scientist who had a long-time interest in UFOs. Now, one of his people, Dr. Robert Wood's people, had heard a talk that he'd gave, that Stan gave at the Washington Research Laboratory, and recommended that Stan go to work trying to back-engineer flying saucers using some blue sky and what Stan calls far-out thinking funds available through the Manned Orbiting Laboratory program at McDonnell Douglas. Stan says, I packed up a bunch of furniture, clothes, and household goods and headed across the country. Now, when he got there, apparently they were laying off people. They still hired him. They were laying off 5,000 people at McDonnell Douglas. They hired him anyway, and he says, even so, they honored his contract and let him stay there for 3 months. I researched magneto-aerodynamic propulsion systems, similar to in principle to an electromagnetic submarine developed by a Westinghouse scientist, that might explain the hypermaneuverability of flying saucers and their ability to overcome the obvious problems of heating, drag, sonic boom production, and reduced radar cross-sections. I found references to hundreds of papers in the mostly non-academic literature. The great majority were classified, indicating the government was certainly interested in such technology. My 3 month stay at McDonnell Douglas was followed by 6 months at TRW Systems. Keep in mind, too, TRW is Dan Golden's group where he came from, who is now the director of NASA, where I worked on the Pioneer spacecraft that have now left the solar system. When the contract ended, I was back full-time on the lecture circuit. Except for consulting work, I was finished with industry for good and became the only space scientist known to devote full-time to UFOlogy. Now, again, I might be reading too much into this, but it sounds to me like, from what Stan is saying here, that there are certain scientific insiders who have a greater knowledge than we are realizing about, you know, the technology that's behind UFOs and that type of thing, and even alludes to the idea that they're back engineering this stuff. And this kind of brings us to my guest tonight, because one of the stories that you hear, in 1989, Area 51 became famous, if you will, when a character named Robert Lazar told the public that he had worked out there at the test site and had worked on some pretty exotic technology that had to do with extraterrestrial spacecraft. Now, over the time, according to Stan, even Stan Friedman claims that he has been unable to verify the veracity of Lazar's story. And, of course, you know, Lazar has been very elusive and evasive about, you know, different aspects of his involvement out there. Nevertheless, there have been some interesting films that have been made, photographs taken and films made of some very unusual aircraft flying around out there at Area 51 in Nevada. And, of course, over the years, this controversy has been a hot topic, whether or not the government is involved in either alien technology, or are they back engineering something that might have been recovered in a crash. It's anybody's guess. Now, my guest tonight is Terry Hansen. And Terry has been involved or interested in UFOs since the late 60s. He's written a couple of papers on the controversy over UFOs. He's even done a documentary for National Public Radio. He's currently the editor of the Puget Sound Computer User Magazine and also Cybernautics Digest. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the program tonight Terry Hansen. Good evening, Terry.
Good evening, Michael.
Thanks for being on the program. Now, this paper that you wrote is called The Psychology of Dreamland, How Secrecy is Destroying Public Faith in Government and Science. Before we go to our first break, give us a real quick thumbnail sketch of the paper.
Okay. What I tried to do in this article was, it's really written for people who are relative newcomers to the subject of UFOs, who may feel that the whole subject is really nonsense and that there's no real substantial issues to be concerned about. And I tried to take people from the, I used the Area 51 controversy as a kind of jumping off point into the broader issues that this phenomenon raises for society and for science as well. And I kind of conclude by saying that that science has sort of sold out. The traditional role of science, the role of science that the public is given in high school and college, is that science is an open inquiry into the nature of human experience.
Right.
And the point I try to make in this article is that in reality that just isn't the case. There's certain types of information that can be disseminated openly, but there are obviously other areas of knowledge that human beings, you know, the average American citizen just doesn't have access to.
Right.
And the reason for that is, you know, national security, as the people in the intelligence community define that.
I think it's more political, but we're going to get into that. And welcome back my guest from Seattle, Washington, Terry Hansen. He is the author of a paper that has been published on the World Wide Web. And later in the hour, I'm going to tell you how you can get access to it with a computer and a modem and your Internet service provider. And in the meantime, Terry, welcome back to the program.
I'm glad to be here.
Before we go too much further, for our new listeners and for people who may not know what Area 51 is, give us a little summary of what Area 51 is and why is it so controversial.
Okay, well, there's a large area of land in Nevada, east of Las Vegas, which the government has used for many decades to test all types of military technologies, everything from nuclear warheads to spy planes. Area 51 is a small part of this large complex, and it's kind of in the eastern part north of Las Vegas, and this is where the Air Force tested the SR-71 and the U-2 and a number of other classified aircraft that have since become public knowledge. About 1984, something unusual happened there. The Air Force seized about 89,000 acres of public land with no explanation. They just took it illegally. And they were hauled before Congress to testify why they did this, and they weren't. They said, "Well, we can't tell you." So it was a very mysterious event that occurred there. Some years later, about March 1989, As you mentioned earlier, there was a guy named Bob Lazar interviewed on KLAS television in Las Vegas who claimed that he had actually worked on and seen operating basically flying saucers, alien technology.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, added to the general controversy and
yeah.
mystique of the whole area, and it brought large numbers of people as well as many film crews and reporters and journalists to the area. The Air Force, in order to keep these people from seeing what was going on at the base, apparently, decided that it had to take some additional land out of the public domain because there were a couple of mountain peaks, Whitesides Mountain and Freedom Ridge, as it was dubbed, from which you could still see the base while being on public land. And the Air Force didn't want that going on, so they applied to the Interior Department, and it was taken out of the public domain, I think, earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a number of stories and myths and so forth surrounding what's been going on there, and you can sort of decide for yourself what you want to believe. Some people say that it's really all about the fact that the Air Force has been dumping some extremely toxic material illegally on the base, and that's what they're trying to protect themselves from. They don't want to be culpable to a lawsuit if it becomes public knowledge that they've been doing these highly illegal activities. And the other story, which is much more sensational, of course, is that you know, there really is alien technology being tested in that area. So you can kind of decide what you want to believe. Now, as far as the alien technology story, there are many, many reasons for believing that that might be the case. I mentioned to your producer earlier that astronaut Ed Mitchell recently publicly stated that he had talked to a number of people with very good connections in the government who confirmed to him that indeed is what's happening there. So now, is this really what's happening, or is it part of some kind of elaborate disinformation scheme?
Right. Can we take Ed Mitchell's word for it as well?
Yeah, good question.
Right.
The only way to really know would be if you could say as a journalist, well, let me go look. And of course, you can't do that.
Sure. No.
They won't let you in there.
That's the beauty of the whole mystery. Yeah. Is that it's
another interesting thing. I get a newsletter called the Secrecy in Government Bulletin, which is published by the Federation of American Scientists. And that's an organization that has been attempting to reduce the amount of secrecy in the world of science. And they report on a program called Inside Edition, where Air Force Secretary Sheila Widnall was asked whether the government is using technology from captured UFOs in its secret aircraft programs. And she didn't say no. She rebuffed the question. She said, I'm not even going to discuss it. So what does that mean? That's not a no. It's not a yes, but it's not.
Right.
You know, she didn't deny it. So, there are many, many reasons like this, and they all kind of point in the same direction that maybe indeed there really is something going on.
Now, I want to kind of go into a couple of different aspects that are very fascinating. One of them, and I know that you have had an interest in this for many years, and you've done an exceedingly good job, I think, in your paper of pointing out some of these interesting connections, but one of the things that we've talked about before on this program goes back to the early 1950s when there appears to have been a decision made by the government, whoever that is that represents the government, that the UFO problem, in other words, you can distinctly, by the Robertson panel in 1952, you can see where there was a definite split or a fork in the road where the scientific aspect of this was basically shoved away, completely out of sight, out of mind, and UFOs, according to the government, became an intelligence problem.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because one of the things that I'm real excited about doing this program is that we're talking about a sociological angle, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What could really be going on here in the vein of, say, psychological warfare or manipulation of the American public? And I noticed that in your article at the first page, you talk about these maps that are available and the kind of thing that you surmise from that.
Yeah, it's quite clear that if you look at the maps of Area 51, historically, there's a certain point where this base, which was on maps at one point, simply disappeared off the maps. it just vanished. The government agencies that are responsible for drawing maps apparently were told or asked not to include the information about
right.
the base.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could say, well, they're doing that because they don't want the Soviets to know about the base. But that's ridiculous because the Soviets fly satellites over all the time. They know about the base. It's, you know, they've known about it for many, many decades, and everyone else does too. It's kind of public knowledge in the intelligence community that that base exists. So what it suggests to me is they're really not concerned about the Soviets or other military powers. What they're concerned about is the American public. They don't want the American public to know what they're doing there.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that they're probably very concerned that if the public kind of gets its teeth into this, or if the journalistic community begins to dig into it, they're going to find some rather surprising and maybe shocking things. And you know, one of them may be that there is a fairly large-scale program going on that's off the budget, and that a lot of illegal funds have been being diverted into this type of activity.
Could this activity not include extraterrestrials? Are you talking about maybe just exotic technologies?
Well, it could include a whole range of things. Extraterrestrial technology might be one of them, but it might be all sorts of other things as well that they just don't want the American public to know about.
Okay, this is Terry Hansen. Terry, we've been talking now about the intelligence factor here. What has your research uncovered? And I want to explore what your feeling is about why and what they're up to. What are they doing? Why are they doing this?
Well, I think they're, in my judgment, there are probably two principal objectives that the intelligence community is involved with UFOs. One is probably technological. In other words, they want to learn as much as they can about how UFOs operate, where they come from, and so forth, so that they can apply this for military applications. Obviously, if you can figure out how to do the kinds of things that UFOs are reported to do, you'd have some pretty impressive weapons technology and you'd pretty much rule the planet.
Right.
But another aspect of this is that I think the government is extremely concerned about the psychological impact of public acceptance that various forms of very sophisticated intelligence are not only here but are deeply involved in our affairs in various ways. And there are lots of reasons to reach this conclusion, but I want to kind of quote a little article by Victor Marchetti, who wrote a book with John Marks called The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. And Victor Marchetti was a former executive assistant to the deputy director of the CIA. He said, in this was 1979, that we have indeed been contacted by extraterrestrial beings, and the U.S. government, in collusion with other national powers of the Earth, is determined to keep this information from the general public. The purpose of the international conspiracy is to maintain a workable stability among the nations of the world and for them, in turn, to retain institutional control over their respective populations. Thus, for these governments to admit that there are beings from outer space with mentalities and technological capabilities obviously far superior to ours could, once fully perceived by the average person, erode the legal foundations, religious, economic, and social institutions. So, you know, the issue there is that it's very much like the Catholic Church in the time of Galileo and the Scientific Revolution. The Catholic Church maintained its political power by controlling what people believed. As long as people believed that the Catholic Church knew what was going on and was in control of the situation, things functioned fine. The status quo was maintained. But once the Scientific Revolution got started and began to question the assumptions that the public had up until that time, it began to erode the power and influence of the Catholic Church. And I think this is really what the issue is about UFOs to a large extent. I think the government, not only in this country but other countries as well, have decided, whether it's legitimate or not, that this information can't be officially acknowledged. Otherwise, it will destabilize our society.
That brings us to a question then. What we perceive in the public sector, you know, people like us in the public sector and my listeners and people in the, you know, just people out there, what does that tell us about what we know? Do we know anything, or is this just all smoke?
Well, I think we do know some things, but clearly our view of reality is filtered through the media to a large extent.
So they're shaping it.
Yes, absolutely. And this is not. I mean, people are kind of led to believe that the media is like a like a mirror. It's just reflecting what's going on. In fact, it's the media is managed to a large extent by a variety of forces, corporations, government. You know, some types of information is disseminated. Some types of information are kept under wraps. So I think the government really is kind of engaging in what you might call a reality management exercise here. When UFOs first became publicly known in the mass media about 50 years ago with the Kenneth Arnold sighting, it became a problem for the intelligence community, and they began to take a look at this, and they realized that whatever was going on, they wanted to keep it out of the press as much as possible. And the Robertson panel, which was CIA's one of the organizations CIA set up to deal with this problem, decided that this problem had to be managed through what they called a program of covert debunking and training. And it kind of had a number of different aspects, but one of them was to keep UFOs out of the press as much as possible, and the second was to provide an explanation, a sort of prosaic explanation to every sighting that came up.
Now, NICAP, which was the premier group, I think, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was made famous, I guess, by Donald Kehoe, was, in fact, a group that was penetrated, or if you can call it that, I think that was sort of probably appropriate terminology, was penetrated by these intelligence types.
Yes.
And they ultimately destroyed the organization.
Well, it certainly looks that way. I mean, it's pretty obvious that there were a very large number of CIA people in NICAP, and not just, you know, low-ranking personnel, but very highly placed people going all the way up to the leadership of the Central Intelligence Agency. So this is kind of interesting. I mean, here you have an organization that the government is trying to tell us, well, you know, UFOs really aren't very important, but yet it's quite obvious that they're important to somebody in the Central Intelligence Agency because they had all these people, infiltrating the NICAP organization, and it rapidly went downhill from there. And the only other time, well, there was one other major attempt to get government-sponsored investigation into the UFO phenomenon, and that was the Condon Commission. Well, Edward Condon was also a guy who had very close ties to the intelligence community. He
right.
was,
mm-hmm.
you know, involved in the Manhattan Project, and he was basically, you know, a team player. So, you know, as you begin to look into this further and further, you find that all of the people who are out there active in the media making statements about UFOs have some type of intelligence community connection. And it's pretty clear that there's, you know, a pattern begins to emerge that this, you know, the information is being actively managed by the intelligence community.
What is the, I guess, you know, this knife cuts both ways, if you will. What's the downside? I mean, I think that's becoming apparent to most people, but the downside of giving someone that much power. For example, you know, the whole notion that in 47, when the National Security Act was brought into action, that basically gave the people within the government carte blanche to make decisions
yes.
for us. What what do you see as a problem with that? I mean, I myself personally find it very troublesome.
Well, I think, you know, I think that it's been counterproductive as far as the government goes. I think the government instituted these policies of secrecy probably with somewhat good intentions. In other words, they basically didn't want society to come apart at the seams and chaos to reign. And so acting out of fear, they began to adopt kind of totalitarian principles, and they began to abandon the democratic open society that we had prior to about 1947. And I think that this has really led to a widespread and very profound distrust of government, which you see manifested in all sorts of ways in our society today.
Okay. All right. I agree with you on that. The thing is that, I can see also other things that might, fall into place with that. But one of the things that sticks out in my mind the most is the fact that one of the concerns that they had early on with the listening projects, you know, the forerunner of SETI was Project OSMA. I guess a lot of papers were generated by scientific people who said, maybe we don't want to listen to this stuff. Maybe, we might be dealing with espionage from an intelligence that is outside of the realm of human intelligence. You know, these are factors that could be possibly at play in all of this.
Yeah, I once interviewed John Billingham, who was, I don't know what his exact title was, I think it was director of the SETI project, NASA's SETI project at the time. And I asked him, you know, after asking him a lot of questions about SETI, I asked him, well, John, what is going to happen if you're successful? I mean, do you really honestly believe that if you obtain highly sophisticated, technologically advanced information, that you're going to be able to publish this in the open literature? And he became extremely defensive at that point. And he just, you know, he said, look, this is just a small project. We're just trying, you know, he realized that I was touching on a very sensitive point, and that is that knowledge always has a political dimension to it. You see this very well in the problem of nuclear proliferation. We can't simply allow everyone in the world to have nuclear weapons. I mean, it's, you know, high-powered rifles are bad enough. So, you know, as we become more and more sophisticated and knowledgeable with science and technology, it becomes more and more of a threat to society in general and, you know, our everyday health.
Right. Terry Hansen, we're talking about the psychology of dreamland. Also joining us now from California is MICAP, our sister organization's resident psychologist, Dr. Greg Wheeler. Good evening, Greg.
Hi, Mike.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
And, you're welcome.
You're on here with us with Terry Hansen as well, Terry.
Hi, Greg.
Hi, Terry. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I greatly respect your Dreamland article. It was really fascinating and great listening to you.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Now, Greg, the question I have for you is this, and we've been talking about the psychology of secrecy, in essence, and one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about is essentially, what is your take as a psychologist on this type of activity, you know, concerning the secrecy, how they're doing it, the manipulation, apparently, of all of our world views, if you will, and do you think we could handle the revelation that there's an extraterrestrial intelligence here?
Well, I've been listening for some time to Terry's what he was saying and what you guys were talking about, and I think that the principal problem that the current policies generate is massive paranoia. I mean, I think that Oklahoma City is sort of an example of paranoia at its most extreme. The government is not only the enemy, but is to be destroyed. I think that policy is very, very bad as it results in such activities. I think there's a better way. I think basically if the justification for mass secrecy is a study done in 1960 or 61, you know, the Brookings Institute study has been talked a lot about would massive societal changes would result. I think that is way out of date. I mean, since that time we've landed on the moon. There's been, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, aliens, et cetera. I think public consciousness is really much further along.
Well, the question I have with that respect is that can they possibly be that remiss in their assessment? I mean, surely they are reassessing or reevaluating, you know, as they're going along. My question is, you know, does this not lay some groundwork for some very dangerous mixtures of say, for example, as we've talked about or heard before, rogue activities and that type of thing?
Yeah, I really do. And, you know, I think that I was thinking of a phrase while Terry was talking, if the government position were one of keeping this degree of secrecy, it would be kind of like societal agoraphobia. You know, we cannot look outside the window. We can't go outside the window. We have to stay inside and pretend that it'll all go away. I don't think that's going to happen. We've got to deal with it. We need strategies, coping strategies for facing the prospect of eventual first contact. I don't think it's just fiction. I mean, all the cosmology that I'm aware of indicates, and with the Mars revelation of maybe ancient life on Mars, I think we're probably in an inhabited galaxy, and first contact is doubtless going to happen. We need some way to deal with it as a society, and it's time for, you know, perhaps even a science of first contact.
Okay. Terry, I'm curious now, in your work, when you were working on this notion of the secrecy and that type of thing, what do you see as far as maybe the perceived intentions of an alien civilization as the government might see it?
my opinion is that there probably are a number of different alien civilizations interested in us for various reasons. And it could be that some of the activities are genuinely frightening. In other words, some of them may be hostile to us, or they may be attempting to manipulate us in some very sophisticated manner. And if the government either believes this is the case or suspects it to be the case, I think that they might, you know, this might explain their extreme reluctance to acknowledge that this kind of thing even exists, even though the, you know, public opinion polls show that the public already accepts it. So there could be a real dark side, and that could account for the extreme secrecy that the government is manifesting.
I'm curious, does any of you gentlemen have a comment on this aspect of it? What do you see as the, okay, we're seeing in the public eye a lot of experts, so-called experts, that come out in the field and say, well, for example, at the top of the program, I was quoting out of Stan Friedman's latest book, Top Secret Magic. The notion for me here is that we see a lot of what I call the woo-woo factor in this, you know, the blending of the New Age kind of thinking, the Space Brothers are here. Do you see that any of those types, manifestations of groups and things like that, that do have the ability to manipulate the public's view of things, do you see any of those as maybe having a connection to the murky world of intelligence?
Well, I can take a shot at that, and maybe Greg can comment on it.
Sure.
I think that there certainly are elements in the intelligence community that are very interested in mind control and behavior, control of human beings through psychological warfare and psychological manipulation. And there could be U.S. government agencies that have an interest in this, or there could be, you know, splinter organizations that have found a way to capitalize on this type of thing. So, yeah, that's a real possibility.
You know, part of this is, it brings up the question of why have a private UFO investigatory organization like MICAP or Paranet. And I go back to the Copernican Revolution. You know, it's really, it's instructive to kind of think that the church was trying to control the information flow. But, you know, it couldn't control the information source. Kepler, Copernicus, Galileo, they all just worked on their own. Galileo just turned the right observational tool on the moon and on Jupiter, and he found out the truth for himself. Much of the UFO data is already public. I mean, people are reporting these things every day. I feel that our organizations like MICAP and like Paranet, the goal is to develop our own methods so that we can arrive at a conclusion. If we have been contacted, it should be something that everyone knows about at the same time, publicly declared. Then, you know, we can decide how to handle it individually if we haven't talked about it publicly. But I feel there's a real purpose for a private investigation. And, you know, Terry's work, obviously, is part of that.
Okay. Terry, in about a minute, we need to wrap this up. It's been a very fascinating program. Where do we go from here with all this stuff?
Well, you know, ideally, I think that it would be good if the government had a period of glasnost. And now that the Cold War is over, I think there are a lot of things that have been covered up that probably should be revealed, and that would at least partially restore some of the respect that the public has for government and science as well. But I think they have a real dilemma here. You know, there certainly are aspects of this that are dangerous for the public to know about. I mean, technologies that might be very disruptive to the global political status quo and so forth. So it's kind of a hot potato for the government. I can understand why they're having difficulty with it.
Greg, do you have any comments you want to make?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think the paradigm of the past is that when subjects were given psychedelics unbeknownst to them and were treated as without the knowledge of what happened to them, it was extremely destructive. And I think that if, for example, abductees were being abducted, that it would help everyone concerned for them to know about it rather than to be looked at as having some kind of other problem. And I just feel like secrecy in any guise, even if it's thought of as necessary, just isn't helpful in this area at all.
Okay. Guys, thank you very much, and I'm afraid that's the last word on it tonight. It's been a pleasure having both of you on. My guest again is Terry Hansen and Dr. Greg Wheeler. We're talking about the psychology of dreamland. So, what a mess. Hey, guys, thank you very much, and we'll see you all next week. Until then, I'm Michael Corbin telling you to keep your eyes on the skies. Good night.